All right, you can put this up if you want. Good morning. It is approximately 10 a.m. on November 12th, 2009. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission. This is our regularly scheduled bi-weekly meeting. Normally, we would meet on Wednesdays, but of course, yesterday being Veterans Day, we use that day to catch up on all of our other work when there aren't so many people around, and are having our meeting on Thursday instead. This is Kevin Kramer, along with Tony Clark and Brian Kulk, welcoming everybody this morning, and a belated happy Veterans Day to Commissioner Kulk and to all of our veterans. Had a wonderful morning yesterday morning at the Bismarck VFW with the Wednesday Morning Breakfast Club, and always fun. Any opening comments by my fellow commissioners?
Just good morning and welcome. Something we can talk about a little later. I recall that we didn't mention it last week, although that probably would have been our first time to discuss it. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission released its order relating to the generation interconnection cost issue that was of concern, especially to Otter Tail Power customers and Montana Dakota Utility customers. It was favorable from our view. It took the position that the PSC had advocated for. We can talk about that a little bit later, but suffice it to say, I think we're all breathing a little bit easier with regard to potential costs that could be coming down the pike for consumers of those utilities.
And I haven't noticed any withdrawal of permit applications from wind companies yet. So we'll see. Good opportunity to talk about it. With that, we will start with KC1.
Make sure we have the consent agenda.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Remove the items on consent.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
KC1. I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order vacating notice of violation 0903 in all respects. Case number RC09316.
Second.
I'll do a brief description of what brings us to this order. On June 17th, the Reclamation Division of the PSC issued a notice of violation to Falkirk Mining Company. It was issued for removing topsoil from a reclaimed area that has received partial bond release for the construction of a haul road prior to approval of the permit revision that contained the design plans for the road. It should be noted, probably right up front, that both the commission staff and the mining company realized later that in fact, that had not received, that it was fully bonded, that it had not received partial bond release, but that it was fully bonded, although that is not all that relevant to the final outcome of the case. What had happened was Falkirk had mistakenly entered into a small reclaimed area of the mine, and when I say small, I mean really small, less smaller area than my yard, I guess, about 0.13 acres of land that was affected. The mistake was seemingly an honest mistake. I think all facts from both parties would concur with that. The what was at stake was that there were two revision permits before the commission. One had been ordered, approved. The other was pending, in fact, imminent. Due to a communication error at the mine, the topsoil was removed from the pending permit area as opposed to the permit area that had been approved for revision. Upon discovering the mistake, Falkirk personnel immediately halted the act, removed the scrapers, informed commission staff, reclamation staff, inspectors, as well as administration, and no harm had occurred to the environment, nor has it since. Falkirk's mistake really was a minor mistake due to miscommunication between their environmental staff and their operations staff. While the Reclamation Division did not order the topsoil to be restored, because it was, remember, subject to this pending revision, in fact, imminent revision. Falkirk Management did go above and beyond and ordered its staff to restore the topsoil, and that work was subsequently completed. As I said, no harm occurred to the environment. The unauthorized work did not pose a potential for adverse environmental impact because it was part of this imminent permit revision. As I said, the area affected is small. It's about 55 by 100 feet, comprising of approximately 0.13 acres. I believe, and the reason that my motion is to vacate the violation, we did have a hearing on it because Falkirk Mine requested a hearing after the penalty was assessed, and so the process of a formal hearing took place. We had the hearing, heard all of the evidence and the testimony, and it was my conclusion, at least, that evidence supports a conclusion that good cause does exist to vacate NOV 0903. Our rules allow the commission or authorized representatives to modify, vacate, or terminate a notice of violation for good cause. I have drafted an opinion. I don't know yet whether it will be a dissenting or a concurring opinion, but I will maybe just read that. It's brief. As I said, I believe the evidence supports a conclusion that good cause exists to vacate NOV 0903. The checks and balances of a three-member commission, which both oversees the division charged with enforcing reclamation laws as well as hears appeals by affected parties, implies that more discretion exists with the elected PSC than for the bureaucracy. Good cause is not defined in our code and lacks clear definition even in law dictionaries. It's a term that is intended to provide discretion to decision makers as they consider all of the evidence and testimony and is dependent on the circumstances of a particular situation and each individual case. The circumstances in this case which support a good cause finding are several, in my view. The mistake which led to the violation was self-discovered, self-reported, and self-remediated. It was discovered within hours of scrapers entering the affected area and reported the same day to reclamation inspectors and administration. The mistake occurred because the affected area was one of two similar in nature. It was an honest mistake. The other had received the permit revision allowing topsoil removal to begin while approval of the permit for the affected area was only pending. As it turns out, approval of the revision was imminent as less than 1 month later the PSC granted the revision. While considering whether good cause exists to vacate the NOV, I contemplated whether there is insufficient cause for issuing the NOV in the first place. I have no quarrel with members of the reclamation staff issuing the NOV as they simply carried out their duties as prescribed in code and by policy. However, by choosing to carry out the letter of the law, I believe we would be violating the spirit of the law. While the various state and federal laws and rules with all of their penalties and consequences are designed to keep industry in check, good reclamation requires a commitment by all stakeholders to environmental protection. If self-reporting an honest and de minimis violation results in penal action by the PSC, we risk compromising the open and transparent relationship between regulators and industry that protects our citizens and land so well. So for those reasons, I'm supporting vacating the NOV.
At this point, I'm going to be moving a substitute motion, and I'll ask for a second, and then they'll both be on the table, and we can, you know, deal with them at that point. I move to substitute the pending motion for the following motion. I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order affirming notice of violation 0903 and reducing the proposed penalty to $0, case number RC09316.
Second.
The motion that I am making and the order that I have attached deals with this a little bit differently. I, too, will be submitting an opinion and don't know whether it will be concurring or dissenting. But by any standard, I think everyone in this case agrees that this was a minor violation. But nonetheless, it was a violation. The staff contends it, the law supports it, and even the company in their testimony admits that it was a violation of the rules that we have. What Falkirk asks us to do as part of this process is to use our discretion to say that while it was indeed a violation, it wasn't really a violation because it was of a minimal nature, a minor violation that was self-reported. I personally don't believe that that is how our law and rule should be interpreted. What we're delving into here is a discussion of what constitutes good cause, because there is discretion that the commission has in relation to this concept of good cause. I personally think that the way that good cause should be defined is when there are things like mitigating uncontrollable circumstances that happen, or perhaps a company, because of those circumstances, has two choices to make, neither one of which may be perfect, but they choose the lesser of two evils and mitigate that. There can be acts of God that take place. Things like that, to me, are good cause where you might vacate a violation. But that's not the case here. What happened was miscommunication between staff, which led to a technical violation of the law. It was minimal, and it was self-reported, but it was still, by everyone's admission in this case, it was, in fact, a violation. So I believe that the proper place to take that type of thing into consideration, where a violation has occurred, but it's a minor one, is in the penalty phase. And so the order that I am proposing affirms that there was a violation that took place, but then forbears from issuing a penalty associated with it, in consideration of the fact that it was a minor violation, it was quickly and properly dealt with, and it was self-reported.
My direct argument with that argument would be that the good cause finding doesn't apply to the company's action as much as it applies to our discretion, or to the PSC's discretion. In other words, I don't know that the company looks at good cause and decides whether to, you know, whether good cause exists for violating the rules, but rather the good cause rests with our discretion on how we would deal with the facts. But your argument is it's solid, it's good, and it's a plausible and intellectually honest description and interpretation. But I do believe that the good cause finding provides that discretion to the commission. And I think, absent a clear definition, good cause is, to me, is one of those things you know and you see. And I think I see good cause here.
Well, I guess for me, we all bring different backgrounds to the commission. And when I first read through this, I mean, it was clear to me that Falkirk has demonstrated good cause. I mean, the background that I bring, they voluntarily reported it. There was miscommunication between their staff. They acknowledged that. No harm occurred. This is also part of a permanent permit revision. I mean, this is pretty clear-cut for me what I thought when it came to it. I would also agree that, our staff did exactly what they're supposed to. They go out and they issue what they believe in the ground, but our role is to then get in the middle if there is good, honest debate. And the good cause, I believe they showed it. So that's where I'm going to fall down on this one.
Okay, we have a motion to accept the substitute motion. We'll do that on a roll call. Commissioner Kramer?
No.
Commissioner Clark?
Yes.
Commissioner Kalk?
No.
Okay, that means we go back to the original motion. The original motion, we'll do a roll call vote as well. Commissioner Kramer?
Yes.
Commissioner Clark?
No.
Commissioner Kalk?
Yes.
Very good. That ends items in my portfolio. Commissioner Clark?
Thank you. TC1. I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in the joint application of Basin Electric Power Cooperative, Inc. and Prairie Winds ND1, Inc. to transfer certificate of site compatibility for energy conversion facility number 14 from Basin Electric Power Cooperative, Inc. to Prairie Winds ND1, Inc., case number PU09692.
Second.
This is an application that I think we knew was coming, and it relates to really corporate ownership status of this particular wind farm that Basin is constructing. This is just a notice of opportunity for hearing, so we will take final action on it at some later date.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC2, I move the commission issue an order in case number GE09705, granting the request of Coppinger Trucking, LLC, to operate a 72,000-bushel grain warehouse at Dickinson, North Dakota, effective November 5th, 2009.
Second.
This 72,000-bushel warehouse has actually been in operation since 2001, but has been used as a cleaning facility. The business has had a roving grain buyer license, but they're actually going to be expanding the business to include grain buying at the facility.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio.
Thank you, Commissioner Culp.
One item in my portfolio today, item BK1. I move the commission approve tariff revisions filed by Montana Dakota Utilities Company to accommodate the extension of daylight savings times under Section 110 of the Federal Energy Policy Act of 2005, case number PU09697.
Second.
Basically, MDU has previously filed tariff revision to remove language related to a temporary shift on-peak hours approved in case number PU0787. The purpose of this shift was to avoid reprogramming time-based meters until it was determined if the daylight savings time changes would become permanent. MDU now reports that it has reprogrammed all its meters with the current daylight savings time standards. Clocks go ahead second Sunday of March. Clocks go back first Sunday of November. This filing removes the language that was inserted into affected time-based tariffs.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Very good. That concludes the agenda. There are not a lot of announcements or short meetings in the short term. However, we don't even have an informal this afternoon, but instead we do have a periodic information exchange meeting with Xcel Energy. We'll talk about a few things, including an update on the gas meter issue. We do have the 3 o'clock work session on the NuStar pipeline issue is being postponed and is on scheduling in the admin portion of the agenda. And then at 4 o'clock, earlier today, scheduled a meeting with the Mental Health Association over their desire to withdraw, or I guess they've actually withdrawn from the 211 designation for emergency mental health hotline assistance. And so that meeting will take place at 4 o'clock without me, but you two guys can handle it.
I'd also like to throw out there that we recently hired the commission, and thanks to staff, Larry Nyquist was just started our public utilities division, so we've got another employee that's helped us out, and glad to have him on board.
If there's nothing else, are there any questions?
Please refresh my memory. What's PI mean?
Periodic Information Exchange.
Thank you. if I understood, I didn't catch on to a couple things you mentioned just a moment ago. Mm-hmm. You're going to meet with Xcel at 1:30 this afternoon, and one of the subjects is
an update on their gas metering situation.
And the NuStar meeting has been postponed, but there's something else at 4 p.m. regarding the Mental Health.
The Mental Health Association was given our 211 designation a couple of years ago when that was, first initiated. And they desire to be relieved of that and have another company in mind for it.
Okay, so this is not just being abandoned, is it? It's going to be transferred to someone else?
That is our hope.
About the Falk Creek mining, I'm trying to kind of discern the difference between Kevin Kramer's position and Tony Clark's, and I guess the difference I see is that Tony Clark says that there was a violation, but there shouldn't be a fine, and you're saying there shouldn't be a violation at all.
That's correct.
Okay. Can you just, first of all, when was the violation detected? I just need kind of a timeline.
May 29th.
May 29th. And when was the error discovered? I mean, can you just... You mentioned that this is self-reported and self-fixed, et cetera.
Within hours of the scrapers going into the wrong area, they removed about 10 loads of dirt, topsoil, to build a haul road that whose permit was pending. So within hours, obviously within about 10 loads, the mistake was discovered by Falkirk personnel and then reported immediately to the reclamation office here, as well as to an inspector who happened to be on site that day.
It was an almost simultaneous catching of it. There was an inspector on site who noted the activity, made a notation of it, and in between the time when he was out in the field and it had happened, Falkirk called into the office and self-reported it.
And they did so without the inspector telling them anything?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, and this happened on, this all happened on May 29th?
It did.
Ten loads of dirt, how much dirt is that? I mean, I've seen, the trucks out there are fairly huge.
Well, yeah, but these aren't coal trucks, of course. These are the scrapers, actually, themselves, 10 loads, scraper loads.
And this dirt was being removed to do what?
To build a haul road.
And this is to build a haul road so that coal mining could take place on this land eventually?
Or in the area, certainly, yes.
And at that time, the permit, the company's mining permit had not been revised.
That's correct. That's correct. The application for the revision is what would allow the haul road to be built. The land was already fully bonded, but the revision would allow the haul road to be built. There were two areas where a similar revision was taking place. The scrapers inadvertently went to the wrong area. The one area the permit had been approved, the other area the permit was imminent, the affected area.
Okay.
In fact, to the point where on June 24th, obviously less than a month later, we issued that approval.
And if this approval had been issued on June 24th, there wouldn't be any problem with this hauling away of the dirt?
If it had been issued on May 24th.
May 24th, yes.
If it had been issued prior to the activity taking place.
On May 29th, you mean?
Right.
Right.
Okay. Well, in other words, the revision that was made on June 24th, if that had been in place at the time that this...
There would have been no violation.
There would have been no
violation. That's correct.
Okay.
Now, don't get me wrong. We don't advocate that, you know, within 30 days of a imminent permit revision being approved, you can, you know, violate the law, but in this case, it was an obvious, honest mistake.
And just so that I'm clear, the inspector on the scene knew that there was a mistake being made, but the employees of the mine did not?
The employee who was operating the scraper did not.
Okay.
Yeah, correct.
What apparently happened was the Falkirk employee in the field who actually was operating the equipment was under the belief that it was all right to begin those activities, did begin them, and then the folks back in the office, when they found out that it was happening, put a stop to it because they knew they weren't supposed to be there.
During the Daryl, let me just throw something else. During the when they came and we had the hearing that day, that was one of the only question I really asked was to see what the company has changed so this kind of mistake doesn't happen again. And they've improved the way they communicate between their operations and their environmental staff. So to me, that was a big thing that they had already done.
Okay, you mentioned that they remediated this mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how well was it remediated?
Well, let me give you, that's a good question. It was remediated well enough that when inspectors went back to look at the area, they couldn't determine which area had actually been affected.
Okay. So in other words, the coal mining company, even though they knew that this land would probably be torn up again fairly shortly, they fixed it.
They had every reason to be confident that it would be approved because the Reclamation Division actually suggested or recommended that they not return the topsoil, but they did anyway, I think, as an act of good faith.
And then they reseeded it. You know, it was in the time of year when this grows fast. So.
Yeah.
Okay. And this land was reclaimed land that was being dug up again, or what? There was mention of reclamation.
Previously permitted land, yeah.
Previously permitted, but reclaimed, yes. Previously mined, reclaimed. Now the permit was being revised for the haul road, which is not an uncommon situation.
So do you know how much it costs to, you know, dig up the land and fix it again?
I don't know.
I don't think that came up.
No, it was never part of the
engine.
No.
I'm a little, I don't understand your logic saying that there is no violation. Could you try to explain that again, please?
I'm saying that the statute and our rules give the Public Service Commission the discretion to vacate an order, to vacate an NOV for good cause. I believe that the de minimis nature of this violation, I believe that the self-reporting, the self-discovery, the self-remediation, the the honesty of the mistake and the reporting of that mistake all creates good cause for vacating it. And I think, and I think, Dale, perhaps the most significant issue for me, besides the de minimis nature of the of all of us and the fact that...
Could you not say de minimis, please?
Does that bother you?
It bothers me a great deal.
Why is that?
I mean, when you go home to your wife, you say, well, I did a de minimis thing today.
No, but we use a lot of terms around here.
It sounds French, and Dale doesn't.
Dale doesn't
like French references.
I'll tell you what really ticks her off is when I go home and say, that was arbitrary and capricious. But at that point, I win the argument. At any rate.
But lose the war.
But the real, yeah, I've never won one. But anyway, but what's really, to me, what's really at stake and why I think it is worthy of vacating the NOV as opposed to just the fine is this issue of the fact that while upholding the letter of the law, we violate the spirit of the law. The spirit of the law is that the people of North Dakota are assured of good, thorough reclamation of mined lands. We have a great record of that. Our companies have a great record of that. The relationship between the reclamation staff and the companies is very important to that, because just as sure as every highway patrolman can't catch every speeder, the fact that there is a speed limit and that most people adhere to it keeps our roads safe. I think the same thing can be said of this example, that we do not want to create an incentive for mining companies to feel that they should not report minor incidences like this, because this incident very well could have been covered up and no violation ever discovered. Even though there was an inspector on site who took note of scrapers in an area, that inspector never went to that area. In fact, I don't think that area was ever inspected until after it was remediated. So, which is another term I never use at home, remediate. So that the most pressing issue for me is this relationship between regulators and the mining company, and the preservation of that transparency, as opposed to creating an incentive to hide things from us.
If I could, too, Dale, that, you know, I went back and reviewed all the NOVs over the last 30 years, I think it was, and this is not the first time that the commission has vacated NOVs for similar type circumstances. So it's not like this is the first time that this has happened.
Does this count as, even though, well, let's just put it this way, if Commissioner Clark's view had prevailed, would this have counted against the company in any future violation?
Yes, it would have. Yes, it would have. Which is the fundamental difference between a zero an NOV with zero penalty and vacating the NOV. Otherwise, I doubt that the lawyer's fees would have been worth, you know, the outcome. I'm sorry, Brian.
Well, and that's part of the concern that I have. If you call something that is a violation not a violation, what happens is you could have consecutive violations that the commission doesn't call violation, but an aggregate. You know, clearly something wrong is happening at the company. I think the better way to deal with this would be, as I indicated, to adjust penalties based on the minimal nature of violations, as opposed to simply calling violations not violations.
I've used the de minimis argument with the highway patrol. It's never worked very well. You mentioned something about the FREC.
The FERC. Yeah, sure. As you may know, there's been a great deal of concern over the last year or so, both the commission and utility companies in the area, with regard to how the Midwest ISO tariff worked with regard to generation interconnection. Basically, what happens is when a generator of any kind, whether it be a wind generator or nuclear or coal or anyone else, under the rules that had been in place, when they sought to interconnect and there were transmission upgrade costs associated with that, the formula was such that the generation developer paid 50% of those costs and the local utility company Therefore, the local utility company's ratepayers paid 50% of those costs. Now, in the old days, it didn't really matter that much because typically utility companies were building for their own systems and for their own networks, and so you weren't exporting power. What's happened with the advent of wind power for export, which is where a good deal of the proposed wind power is planning to go, is you would have situations where developers from Ohio or Illinois or anywhere in the entire Eastern Interconnection could come in and seek to place wind where it's windiest, which just happens to be on the systems of companies like MDU and Otter Tail that operate in rural areas, don't have a lot of customers to spread these costs over. When they started looking at the amount of wind for export that was looking to interconnect with their systems and the amount of transmission upgrade costs that this would incur for transmission and energy that customers of MDU and Otter Tail don't need, a company like Otter Tail, if just 20% of those projects went through, could see end-use ratepayer consumer impacts of up to 30% rate increases. And again, for power that's solely for export, that is of no benefit at all to their customers. I think everyone acknowledged that it was a problem. The question is, what do you do about it? There was a proposed solution at the FERC, which they adopted, which I think was a good thing, which basically said that when you have a generation interconnection cost, it's going to be when it's 345 kV or less, the generator that's seeking to interconnect will pay 100% of those costs. Where it's greater than 345, it'll be a 90-10 split, with 90% being the generator, 10% going to the entire Midwest independent system operator footprint. They did indicate that the FERC sees this as a temporary fix. Next year, there's going to be a filing in which they hope to see a little bit different methodology. They don't identify what it'll be, but these cost methodologies are evolving. But what it really means for consumers is in North Dakota is that it buys us some time and some breathing room, and it's effectively like I'd often compare it to a triage. I mean, the patient was bleeding. Otter Tail and MDU were going to get out of the Midwest ISO if they couldn't fix this particular problem. The FERC performed some triage, stopped the bleeding. We now have a cost allocation methodology where at least ratepayers won't be harmed, and we can try to fix the entire system over the intervening months.
And then we can start talking about pancakes and license plates again.
To what extent is this the groundwork for a permanent solution? I mean, is the permanent solution going to be along these lines? Or?
I don't know that it's necessary. I wouldn't call it the groundwork for a permanent solution. I think it's a temporary fix. I don't know exactly what the permanent solution will be. There are a lot of discussions within the region about some different methodologies that are being proposed, and I'm not going to get into this in any great detail, but the one that seems to be emerging that the Midwest ISO is talking a lot about is called the injection withdrawal model, which is where, depending on whether you're injecting power into the network or withdrawing it from the network, there are different cost allocations that are divvied up. That seems to be the one that, at least from the MISO side of things, is gaining some momentum, and they're really offering up. But I don't think that bears a lot of relationship with this fix.
Wouldn't it be safe to say that what the position that they have now is what we would like to keep it that way?
Well,
for us, North Dakota.
Well, if we were going to be completely selfish, maybe. But
I mean, there is a reality that this fix and does. It does put a damper potentially on wind development in the state, and in the short term, that was fine. I mean, we were looking at some pretty dramatic rate increases that would have put a real damper on wind power development in North Dakota because people just simply would sour on having any wind farms built. Because there are wind resources elsewhere, for example, the Southwest Power Pool, which has a little bit different methodology, which is a little bit more favorable towards wind developers. If this was in place for long term, it could have an impact in shifting wind development to a different region of the country. So I think that there's a recognition that really what we want at the end of the day is that those who benefit from new power coming online are the ones that pay for it. This helps get us closer to that, but it may not be the be-all and end-all.
When you're as major a producer and exporter of electricity as we are, you know, we do want to be careful not to send signals to the GNT world that, you know, we have great resources, but it's going to be tough to build here either. I mean, as I always say, transmission is not built in a vacuum, and it requires some give and take by lots of parties to find the most equitable and fair distribution and allocation of costs. This certainly illustrates that.
I mean, you mentioned this, but if you have a situation now where the wind developer would pay 90% of the expense of transmission, is there going to be less? I mean, are the wind companies going to say, well, we'll sit this one out until something better comes along?
They may draw back for some period of time. There are a number of projects that are already in the queue and that are moving along and being constructed, so I'm not overly concerned about that. And the reality is FERC has asked for a further tariff revision here in next summer. So that particular issue doesn't give me a great pause for concern. I mean, the bottom line is by putting it on the generator, eventually it gets passed through to the end-use customer. Some of these other models more explicitly put those costs through to the end-use customers, and really the issue that we're dealing with is the upfront cost for the generators, and that can become a barrier to entry. So at the end of the day, the movement is definitely towards ensuring that the beneficiary pays. How you get that is a topic that's up for discussion.
And there, of course, there's always some acknowledgement that any new transmission, especially large transmission, benefits the entire footprint, if you will, which is why the 90-10 split makes sense for a 345 kV and larger line. It's very, very complicated.
So is it fair to say that this is preferable because under the previous plan, the ratepayers who are living where the wind power is would bear half the cost of transmission, whether or not they use that power? This new scenario, they potentially bear only 10%?
Right. I mean, people in North Dakota were looking at potentially rate impacts of up to 30% on their bill simply because they happen to live in a windy place. And it was just a matter of the fact that they happen to have utility companies here that, relatively speaking, are fairly small and happen to be pretty geographically broad and have lots of miles of transmission line, and those miles of transmission line happen to overlay the windiest spot on the North American continent. So
can you explain to me, I mean, you mentioned that this gets passed, the new method means that most of this would get passed through to the end users.
Well,
of this cost.
Right.
Did I understand you correctly?
Right. If a generator knows what the cost to interconnect will be and what the transmission upgrade cost will be, then you would have to assume that the generator is going to build those costs into the purchase power agreement and the contractual agreements that they get into as they sell the power. So it'll cause the power cost to go up, and eventually the end-use customers will pay for that.
Well, the question I'm getting to is, why isn't that considered the standing operating procedure?
Well, because the tariff, yeah.
It's a lot of it has to do with the upfront cost issue that the generator themselves then have to foot that upfront cost. And in theory, I think economically, you could make a strong argument for that. In practice, when you're funding projects like this, it perhaps might be better to have a little bit different mechanism where the end-use customer upfront pays for some of those costs. And at the end of the day, they end up paying the same thing. But as far as project financing, it does make it a little bit easier to have development.
You know, to put it in some perspective, Dale, it's $300 million production costs for a wind farm are pretty standard these days. Interconnection, depend on distance and all that, but an interconnection to an existing transmission line might be $10 to $20 million, and half of which would be, under the old scenario, would be have to be paid by the utility. So, the $10 million difference in a $300 million-plus dollar wind farm doesn't seem to be that big a burden, in my view.
The other issue that comes into play is that and generators are correct when they make this statement. If you peg everything on the generator and there are large transmission upgrades that are needed, what that does is it frees up capacity everywhere else in the network. And then other developers can come in and basically be free riders. If there isn't some ability to recapture some of that for the folks who've upgraded the transmission line. So the analogy that they sometimes use, which is, you know, pretty close to accurate, is if you had a congested highway and you make that next car that gets on the highway pay for all of the upgrades that are necessary to expand the highway, then everyone else benefits from it freely. That's the other issue that doesn't get captured in this particular formula, and that I think that future tariffs are looking at trying to better address.
How long do you think it'll take for this permanent fix to...
Well, they pegged, what, June or July, Jerry, for a revised tariff? FERC asked for...
Which means next fall. Maybe.
2011.
The FERC pegged the filing conditionally approved on a June, I want to say 15th or 10th or something like that deadline, to file a revised program. And the revised program is being developed now. But whether or not it stays with the injection withdrawal that they're talking about or something else comes along isn't known yet. And if something else comes along, then the filing could take longer than June. And even if it doesn't come along, the June date is fast. So
when was the temporary fix arrived at?
It's not arrived at yet. It's in the process of being worked out among all of the stakeholders.
No, you're talking about the FERC order? The FERC order was October 23rd.
October 23rd, okay. I wanted to ask as well about the demise of the Big Stone project and how this affects power transmission in North Dakota. Specifically, I'm thinking of the CapEx 2020 initiative. I guess what I'm really getting at is, does the demise of the Big Stone project have any effects that you can see on the ability of power producers in North Dakota, particularly wind power producers, to transmit?
Absolutely.
The biggest impact is eventually going to be on ratepayers, I fear, which is just because the utility companies made an overwhelming case last year that this was, at the time, the most affordable, cheapest resource that could be brought online. And because of various reasons, primarily because I think the financial community, the finance community, is scared to death of what's happening in Washington, D.C., apparently the utility companies didn't believe that they could move forward with this. So that means that necessarily we are going to be moving on. The utilities will be looking at higher cost resources, and that's unfortunate that uncertainty that's coming from Washington, D.C. is causing this to happen, because eventually ratepayers will pay for it. Now, with regard to export, there is potential that it harms North Dakota's ability to export. One of the facts that was brought out in the case is that by having Big Stone, it basically, the analogy that the engineers used was it propped up a sag in the line, and so it expanded potential wind production from the Dakotas. And without Big Stone, there is a risk that expanded production potential does decrease. It wasn't specifically tied to CapEx 2020 necessarily. That still goes forward, and that will help as well. But this was an additional outlet that now doesn't exist.
Dale, as I recall, it was the shoring up of the transmission line by the Big Stone 2 project would have provided as much as 500 megawatts of increased capacity out of the Great Plains of North Dakota. That's a pretty tremendous freeway that has now been blocked or closed. Now, the irony of that is, of course, this uncertainty that Tony speaks of comes from people whose motive is supposedly to have more clean, green electricity in places like Minnesota. So by virtue of creating this uncertainty, both at the federal level and at the Minnesota state level, they've not only harmed their ratepayers' chances of having low-cost energy produced by coal. They've also, by the way, I think it's another important fact here, is that Big Stone 2 set the stage for replacing equipment in Big Stone 1 to the point where the two plants together would have emitted fewer carbon tons than the one. Now, isn't that ironic? In addition to that, it opened up a freeway for more wind energy development. So once again, common sense eludes Washington, D.C., which ultimately harms the very goal that they seem to be, or at least they state that they're aiming for.
Well, Dale, if I just could throw just a general thought that, my concern is that the policies that are being developed outside of North Dakota are what is really going to hurt our future. It's not what we're doing in this state. We're doing things very well, but every policy that we've talked about, the FERC's changing of the tariffs, the cap and trade, none of those will keep our costs down. All of them are going to raise the cost of electricity in North Dakota, and are going to, no matter how you slice it, it'll reduce our competitive advantage for industry. So that's why, personally, there's no way that we need to be quiet about any of these things. We need to be adamant about our positions that are good for our state, because there's nobody outside of North Dakota that's going to do something that's going to benefit us besides what we're doing, and all these policies will hurt us. And you can quote me on that.
Thank you.
There's nothing else. We'll recess for a few minutes while we sign orders and then come back for the administrative portion of the agenda, which is also short.